everybody. Welcome to the New in Chess podcast. My name is Dirk-Jan ten Geuzendam. In the New in Chess podcast, we speak to leading grandmasters, authors, trainers, and other personalities from the fascinating world of chess. The New in Chess podcast is brought to you by DGT, the leading producer of chess clocks and sensory chess boards. DGT clocks and boards are used in major and minor competitions all around the world. Today's guest is American coach and chess writer Charles Hurton. His book, Forcing Chess Moves, won the 2008 Chess Cafe Book of the Year Award, and he's the author of the successful Power Chess for Kids series. We've invited Charles to the New in Chess podcast to speak about his latest book, The Real Paul Morphy. The book came out last week and focuses on the life and games of the great American champion Paul Morphy, one of the biggest stars the game has ever seen. Morphy dazzled the world for only a couple of years with his brilliant play before he withdrew from all chess competitions and tragically died at the young age of 47. Charles, hello. Thank you for joining us from Massachusetts.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
An author who writes a book about one player must have a special bond with that player. Where does your fascination with Morphy come from? I mean, how did this book come about?
He's always been an amazing chess figure. You know, I studied his games from the time I was young, but really the book evolved out of a process of my original concept was to write a book about great American chess players, maybe the top 5 or 10. So I was, you know, compiling databases. I was studying their games. And then I particularly got interested in Morphy and Harry Nelson Pillsbury. And what I found as I continued my research was I was very drawn to the life of Paul Morphy. He's so fascinating. And, you know, the time and place he lived, New Orleans in the 1830s, was a very interesting subject. And I have a very avid interest in biography and history. So I really got drawn into that. And then, you know, of course, in the process of writing the book, I developed more appreciation for Morphy's games, and his influence on chess theory and development only grew the more I immersed myself in his games.
Well, obviously, Paul Morphy is being seen as one of the great champions of all time. The only doubt you occasionally hear is that people nowadays say, was he, well, really that good, objectively speaking? And your conclusion, in fact, was that yes, he was extremely good, and it still makes sense to study his games.
Yes, absolutely. The more I look at his games, the stronger I feel that he was, and computers bear that out. You know, for a player of his era, his accuracy was incredible. And great champions, including Fischer, have lauded him on that basis. He was a brilliant thinker. He revolutionized the whole approach to chess and to mastery and to studying the game. And experts like his English contemporary Samuel Bowden, commented that he was so strong that he only needed to use a fraction of his talent for chess to dominate the world. There's no telling what he could have done if he stayed with it longer. His competition was not as strong as later champions, but I don't think that detracts from his strength.
Do you think he was one of those miracles? I mean, a phenomenon like, say, Mozart, who is so exceptionally gifted that it's, in fact, very difficult to explain how he could be that good. I mean, if you see what his background was, and so a lot of what he thought up just came from his inner self. So that there must have been an immense talent there.
I try to make a strong argument in the book that Morphy very well might have been the most gifted player of all time. The feats he accomplished are astounding. He was beating world-class players when he had no tournament experience and hadn't read books, as far as we can tell. He did have an uncle who was a very strong teacher, and he had, good competition. He did play master competition in offhand games. But, in terms of, the fact how he came out of the blue, there's really no parallel in chess history for his rise. I believe he was the most gifted player who ever lived, and Fischer seemed to second that idea.
Yeah, wasn't it Fischer who said that in some positions he really had to think for a long time to come up with the move that Morphy came up with?
Right. And he also called him the most accurate player who ever lived and the greatest genius of them all. So yeah. That's pretty high praise from a player that some consider the greatest ever.
Yeah. And initially, the story is so beautiful. I mean, he's this prodigy. Then he plays his first big tournament, the first American Congress, the first American championship. And he wins that in a very convincing manner. And then there's this trip to Europe where he just beats everyone. It's almost too good to be true.
Yeah. Well, he's a unique genius. It's hard to imagine anyone going the route he did and doing what he did. I mean, in a sense, we'll never know because today with the internet, there's so much information available, which in the old days, you took 5 or 10 years of international experience to get, So it's hard to know, but I don't know that anyone could ever accomplish what he accomplished. As I said in the book, he basically never had a setback in his whole career.
Yeah.
Even in an individual match, we don't know of any time where he lost or was outplayed, from the club all the way to the world championship. I mean, that's just stunning.
Yeah, unless there were circumstances that explained this. I mean, there were these first games against Anderson when he was clearly ill, and I think something similar happened against Hurwitz. But then there was a, easily understandable reason for that.
Right, and then, even against Hurwitz, his lowest margin of victory in a serious match was 5-2 against Hurwitz.
Yeah.
It's still a dominating win, and Hurwitz quit when had a good time for him because he was pretty much under Morphy's spell by then and probably would have lost a lot more games.
Yeah. Well, let's say in the book, you chronologically follow his life and the story is interspersed with the games, which I find very attractive that you immediately see what games you're talking about. And it reads like a film script sometimes. As you say, the story is so unbelievable. And one of the photos that you liked so much of General Winfield Scott. And I just imagine that scene in a movie that he comes to, I think he came to the house of the Morphys, didn't he? To play him.
No, it was at the club.
It was at the club.
At the local club where Morphy played. Yeah.
And how old was he at that point?
He was 9 or 10.
Yeah.
I think he was 10 years old at that point.
Yeah. And then he's sitting opposite this big general.
Yeah, this decorated old war horse, who's very pompous, a hero, one of the big war heroes of American history at the time.
Who also very much looks like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And, and he thought it was a joke when they offered to set him up with Paul Morphy.
Yeah,
then he huffed off indignantly when he got smashed.
Yeah. Well, what I find curious is that when he played the American First American Congress. And in fact, you get the dream final in the end that he's playing Louis Paulson. Yeah. But in fact, it's by coincidence that it happened that way, because they, it's, I mean, I think for readers today, it is important to realize that tournaments were so completely different that they, can you say something about that?
Yeah. Well, the Congress was modeled on the first international tournament of London, 1851. And so, yeah, they didn't have much experience with, you know, pairing systems and things. So, you know, the best solution that the American Chess Congress Committee could come up with was pairings at random. So, you know, there was a realistic chance that the best players could be paired in the first round and you could have a very anticlimactic final. But yeah, by, you know, by coincidence, for the most part, his opponents did get stronger as he went on, and then he was able to play by far the second best player in America in the finale. And, you know, as I say in the book, things happened that way during Morphy's historic run where, you know, all the stars seemed to align for a storybook ending. You know, so, you know, it's sort of amazing and miraculous that he ended up playing the best players of all the leading chess countries know, at the time. It didn't have to be that way, and it could have very well not have ended up that way. You know, especially in regards to him playing Anderson, because I believe that if Howard Staunton had accepted his challenge to play, I think that was Morphy's goal when he went to Europe, to beat Staunton.
Yeah.
And he could have very well went home after that without playing Anderson, who was truly the European champion at the time.
What I found admirable was that Anderson, that he made a real effort to, well, to travel from his home to meet Morphy, because he saw it as, well, maybe his moral duty to have this match.
Yes. You know, Anderson was not only one of the great players, but he was one of the great ambassadors for chess and, you know, one of the great lovers of chess in chess history. You know, he had a very different style than Morphy or Staunton.
Yeah.
But, you know, of course, his contribution to chess is just being fully realized recently.
You love chess? Why don't you try New in Chess? With readers in 116 countries, New in Chess is the premier chess magazine in the world. What will you get? Exciting chess games explained by the best experts in a clear and accessible way, on-the-spot reports of the biggest events, top-notch instruction, independent journalism, chess history that comes to life, and great interviews. New in Chess, the way you want it. The beautifully produced paper edition, or the digital edition for phone, tablet, or PC. Give it a try. Go to our website, newinchess.com/magazine, for more information about subscriptions and special offers.
Isn't that also the let's say, a wonderful contrast that you have with... So Morphy, in fact, he wants to go to Europe to play Staunton, whom he doesn't get to play. And in fact, the one he has to play, because it's the strongest player at that point, is Anderson, and he plays him, and he is all sportsmanship, which is something which is extremely important to Morphy himself as well. I think that's the kind of thing you start to like him, because he's so cultured, so polite, and has all this sportsmanship.
Yeah. You mean Morphy?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and Anderson. I mean, that was the perfect couple.
Right. Yes. Yeah, people were, you know, in his time, and this is something that you wouldn't realize today without knowing the story, but chess masters were blown away by Morphy's personality. You know, he was sort of a rock star. I mean, everywhere he went, people fell in love with the guy. And I think it's the combination of he had a Mozart-like talent, but he was so humble and approachable. You know, he went to the Café de la Régence in France, and he would play, you know, anyone who came by. He would play an offhand game in a very unassuming, polite, and respectful way. And people were just amazed, you know, to see a champion like this. And part of that was also, of course, the contrast to, you know, Howard Staunton, who had been, you know, the previous champion before Anderson, who was had a lot of airs and, you know, not very approachable and could be very mean even and nasty at times.
Yeah. Well, that was clearly one of the attractions with Morphy, that he was this refined person, almost delicate. What I found amazing is that at some point I had a chance to see this cask of his hand, and it's such a small and delicate hand. It's almost impossible to imagine.
Yeah, he was a Southern aristocrat.
Yeah.
You know, and my feeling is that he was also somewhat of a mama's boy. You know, his mother was a great artist in New Orleans society, and he had this artistic gift. He did not have his father's gift of being a, you know, strong, charismatic male figure. You know, and that was kind of a difficult part of his identity. You know, he wanted to be like his father, but I think in some ways he was more like his mother. And, you know, people appreciated that refinement and that delicacy because he was, you know, such a monstrously strong chess player that the combination just delighted people.
Yeah. Well, as said, well, there was this wish of Morphy to play Staunton, because Staunton, he had this reputation of being, well, some sort of first official world champion after he beat Saint-Amand in 43. Right. And in fact, what I wondered about is, I mean, he didn't even win his own tournament in 1851, which was called Staunton's tournament. I mean, it was such a personal thing. Right. What is your take on this? How do you see this? I mean, there's always been this story that Staunton was just trying to avoid him, didn't want to play him, had all kinds of lame excuses, or he had good excuses, and it simply didn't happen. Well, what would be your final conclusion there?
Right. You know, I think there are people on both sides of it who, you know, defend Staunton or, you know, believe that he was just avoiding playing Morphy, even some of his countrymen. I think the truth is somewhere in the middle. As I write about it, I think Staunton genuinely wanted to play him. You know, first of all, as a matter of honor, he didn't want to, you know, be seen as a coward. But I think what happened was, the more Staunton saw Morphy in person, in Europe, the more he realized that he had no chance against Morphy. He refereed the match between Morphy and Lowenthal, in which Morphy, you know, absolutely demolished Lowenthal. So he saw that firsthand. He saw, you know, all the offhand matches that Morphy had played. A lot of the games were published. So it started to sink in that he had no chance. You know, at that point, Lowenthal was probably objectively stronger than Staunton, and certainly as a practical player, he was stronger. Mm-hmm. So once he realized that he was going to get, you know, humiliated, then he gradually lost his taste to play, and unfortunately, he turned to, you know, his bag of tricks, which was to attack his enemies in the press and to try to villainize Morphy. That, unfortunately, that was Staunton's instinct. You know, Staunton had higher instincts too. He praised Morphy quite a bit in his column. He had a lot of praise for his play. I think he just felt like he was trapped. You know, he was like a cornered animal. And he lashed back, and, you know, that was, you know, the best he could do. But, you know, it turns out that he did actually offer to play Morphy a cable match before Morphy left the United States. But Morphy never received the invitation. He had already sailed for Europe at that time. So I think that Staunton wanted a way out that would be where he could save face and play Morphy, but play him on his own terms. And that's partly why he strongly wanted Morphy to compete at Birmingham. Mm. There was a Birmingham International Tournament that was going on when Morphy arrived. And originally Morphy said he would play. And I think, you know, Staunton was willing to play Morphy a short match, you know, which wouldn't be as conclusive. But he didn't want to play him a long match and lose 9-2 like, you know, like Anderson and Lowenthal.
But you might say that in that sense, history judged as well, because in this tournament in Birmingham, where Morphy didn't play and Staunton did play, he was knocked out in the second round by Lowenthal, who went on to...
That's right.
Yeah. Well, and as you say, Lowenthal, he had been ripped apart by Morphy.
That's right.
So, the stats, they are really not working for Staunton.
That's right. Yeah. And he had his reputation, you know, to uphold. He was, you know, he was a distinguished, you know, professional chess writer, you know. So he was, you know, I think he was making a lot of his living from chess. And certainly he was very invested in his books, his writings, his columns. So, you know, and he had a lot of pride, you know, so he didn't want to subject himself to that.
Well, in any case, it was true that he was working on this collected works of Shakespeare that he...
That's right. That's right. You know, and it is a valid perspective to read between the lines and to say that, well, Staunton never really intended to play a match against Morphy. He kind of... You know, he hinted that he wasn't ready, you know, and that he would play him, you know, when he was able to get back to his former strength, which in reality was never going to happen. So the problem is that then Staunton contradicted himself by coming out in the press and saying, you know, agreeing to a match.
Yeah.
I think part of that was because of Staunton's ambivalence. I think he wasn't quite sure what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
And unfortunately he made a mess of things and then he felt he had no way out but to, you know, to try to knock down Morphy's reputation.
Yeah, I thought that was outright mean what he was writing.
And he could be terrible. Yeah. He could be vicious. You know, with really no good objective reason in the press. And that's partly what hurt his reputation for a long time.
Well, you know? At the same time, it's also good to see that someone like Morphy, who himself, well, behaved impeccably, that he did annoy opponents. Because, I mean, chess players, it hurts if you lose. And you could see that the moment that Hurwitz won one or two games, I mean, the things that he was doing were so rude. You just wait. But of course, everything ends well because then Morphy turns around the match and smashes him. So in that sense, he's a perfect superhero.
Yes, this is true.
So, you rely on many sources many things that have been written about Morphy. One of my own favorites is Frederick Milne Edge's account of his trip to Europe, where he accompanied him as his secretary, as he said. He's also just like Staunton. He's someone who people have double opinions about. How do you see him?
Yeah. I think the double opinions come from the Staunton defenders versus the Staunton blamers. So Edge became linked to, you know, sort of the demise of Staunton's reputation. I think that Edge is a critical figure in chess history, because I think what we found out later was that Morphy had a lot of underlying mental health problems, which fortunately hadn't really, you know, developed yet.
Yeah.
But I think he needed an edge, you know, to help him stay organized, to stay focused on the match. You know, it's largely due to Edge that the Morphy Anderson match came about. Morphy wanted to go home for Christmas, like he had originally promised his family. So I think that you know, Edge was a critical figure in enabling Morphy's success, and B, he was a pretty good writer, and he was, you know, he chronicled the whole trip in a priceless way, you know. So we have day-to-day accounts of, you know, what Morphy said, what he did, what he ate, you know. It's a remarkable book, the Edge book. And, you know, the knock on him is that he was such a vicious critic of Staunton in the press.
Yeah.
And it is true that he took it upon himself to sort of be Morphy's bulldog and to, you know, answer Staunton's attacks. And, you know, so how you feel about that depends on a lot on how you feel about Staunton. You know, and yes, I think that Edge was partly self-serving. You know, I don't think it was, I think he actually was very enamored with Morphy and did see him as a Mozart figure. So he, part of his attaching himself to Morphy was, you know, out of, you know, fascination and, you know, respect for Morphy. But I also think part of it was he knew that he could write a very important book if he attacked, you know, he was putting himself in the ideal position to be a leading Morphy biographer. So it was good for his career as well.
Yeah. But I think we cannot be grateful enough to Edge for the book that he wrote, because it's as you say, it's such a vivid account of what kind of person he was. And I mean, there's so many passages there that I really love. I mean, when they are going back to France, and then Morphy is too slow at breakfast, and you can see that Edge is trying to hurry him up, and then he they missed the boat. Of course, they missed the boat, and you see that whole scene, and you think, "Oh yeah, chess player," you know.
Edge has a very good tongue-in-cheek sense of humor, you know, which is a nice element to add to the story.
And also, I think all the elements that you easily forget about, if you're thinking about, well, what is it, 1858, 59. It's a long time ago. And then you realize that one of the main opponents for Morphy was the lousy water in Paris. And made him ill so often.
Yeah. I mean, he rose from his sick bed. You know, when he played Anderson in game one, he had been sick in bed for 2 weeks. He could barely get out of bed. And, you know, people who saw him said, you know, oh, he's too sick to play. He lost game one, but he played well. And he said, you know, my gut is sick, but my head is ready to play.
Yeah.
And, you know, then he snapped out of it, and he was, you know, fully himself after that. But,
Summer is a great time to work on your chess or to simply enjoy a wonderful chess book. We've just received two brand new quality chess titles in our webshop that you should have a look at. The Mental Game by Alexander Galkin proves that chess is so much more than only openings and technique. The Mental Game follows Alexandra Maltsevskaya as she first won the World Junior Championship and next the European Rapid Championship. Alexander Galkin was her coach and tells the story. Rarely will you get as unfiltered and raw an insight into the struggle to succeed as in The Mental Game. The other quality chess book is Chess Survivor by the legendary Andor Lilienthal, the grandmaster who lived to be 99 and who played or met all the world champions of the 20th century. Most famous is his win against Capablanca in 1935. equally famous is the story that when Bobby Fischer saw Lilienthal in 1992, Fischer immediately said, pawn e5 takes f6, a reference to that Capablanca game. The mental game by Alexander Galkin and Chess Survivor by Andor Lilienthal. Don't forget to check them out in our webshop at newinchess.com. Well, as we know, there's, well, two sides to Morphy. There's the glorious triumphs, and then there's the decline and the dark final years where he suffered from, mental illness. This is yes. something that has your special interest professionally.
Right.
Do you think that, I mean, we should talk about all, let's say, the parallels with him and Fischer. And in uh-huh. Fischer's case, I think you can say that there were traces in his early life of what was going to happen later.
Yeah.
Do you see anything like that in Morphy?
Not so much in his early life. No. People have made a lot about the similarities between Fischer and Morphy, but in terms of mental health, I see them very differently. Mm-hmm. And the main difference is in their upbringing. You know, Fischer had a very good and insightful quote where he said that boys growing up with fathers are like wolves. I think that's a very insightful quote. And, you know, Morphy didn't have to deal with any of that. He had a very privileged upbringing and by all accounts, a very loving upbringing. Mm-hmm. You know, he had two parents who were cultured and, you know, and loving, and he had an uncle who he was very close to. Fischer had none of that. He was on his own. And so, you know, I think that that what Morphy had that Fischer didn't was a lot of life events that were very traumatic, and especially the Civil War and the impact of that on him and his family and being displaced and so he had some later trauma, but in the final analysis, I think they both had, you know, some biological roots of mental mm-hmm. illness, you know, in their psyches. But it was a different kind of illness. Yeah. You know, in Morphy's case, I think, you know, later on it became a very organic mental illness, which could be explained by some kind of brain injury mm-hmm. or, you know, in Fischer's case, I think it could be more an illness that arose from his childhood, you know, trauma and difficulty, and the fact that he did not have a normal upbringing or normal development. He never really, you know, developed as a human being outside of chess. You know, chess was everything for Fischer. That wasn't the case. Morphy went to college and barely studied chess for 2 years, 2 or 3 years, and had a lovely time.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't seem to miss it. So.
Well, it's amazing how many of these parallels there were. I mean, the return of Bobby Fischer to New York after he won the world title and being received by Mayor Lindsay. And Morphy going back there, and it's unbelievable. I mean, the reception that he got in New York when he got back, it's very difficult to compare that to any reception that a world champion has had after him.
Yeah, right. Because you know, he at that point he was considered one of the great Americans of all time, not just chess players. Yeah, it's hard to imagine a chess player meaning that much to, you know, his country, you know, because America was still relatively young then. You know, it was a country that had been in existence for less than 75 years. And he was maybe the first person ever in America to dominate a field of endeavor, and especially an important cultural field, the way that Morphy did. He was considered, you know, a rock star really when he came back. He was, you know, front page news in the press for days on end.
Yeah.
Politicians and, you know, leading local figure wanted to to meet him and be associated with him.
Yeah. Well, if we have this comparison with let's say with Fischer, right, where I feel right. that many of the things that we saw later, you already can see in his early years, and then this just got much worse due to his, well, mental condition, which may be partly yeah. physical. And in Morphy, I mean, there's so much that he did later when he was ill that is impossible to explain. I mean, where does it come from? Yes. Is that just a brain yeah, disease?
Yes, that's a brain disease. Yeah, Morphy, you know, in his later years, Morphy certainly had a chronic major mental illness. You could say that he was floridly psychotic, mm-hmm. which is someone who just, you know, exhibits bizarre behaviors and, you know, someone you would see on the street and you would immediately identify as a crazy person. Mm-hmm. And that was never the case with yeah. Fischer. You know, his illness would come out when he was under stress, you know, or, you know, at particular moments. But Morphy at that point was so biologically mentally ill that he couldn't hide it. Yeah. You know, it was plain to everybody.
Well, he was going for walks in New Orleans and he would see a nice girl and he would really stare at them. And everyone knew that, yeah. okay, this is the innocent Paul Morphy. And right. he was tolerated right. for that. But is that a... Well, a fairly common, well, how do you say, a symptom of such a disease?
Well, I think there are symptoms that were a lot more telling and serious than that, like when he would gesticulate to, you know, invisible people. He would start talking and gesturing, at people who weren't there. You know, he also... attacked his brother-in-law's friend. He became, violent. He also talked gibberish at times. His niece, yeah. you know, witnessed him saying nonsensical things. So, you know, he had a lot of symptoms that you would expect in a schizophrenic or somebody with senile dementia or some kind of brain injury, which is what yeah. I feel that he suffered from later on in life.
Well, there were also a couple of things that I didn't really understand. So you have this memoir of his niece, Regina Voce Morphy, and then she writes at some point about the typical behavior that he has. And one of the things is that he puts his shoes in his room in a regular order, right. and he has them ready for if he needs them, and then Ruben right. Fine, I mean the chess grandmaster yeah. who also was a psychiatrist, he wrote right. this Psychology of the Chess Player, and then right. I don't know if it's him or if it's another source that he bases this right. on. He turns it into women's shoes, and I think, how can you make this up? It feels like a crime to me.
Yeah. Yes, I think so. Mm. You know, and Winter points that out in his blog, and I believe he credits yeah. that error to Ruben Fine. Yeah. His niece said that he kept his shoes in a semicircle yeah. so that he'd have easy access to whatever pair he wanted when he went out. That's how Murphy yeah, yeah. explained it. And then apparently, yeah, as far as I can tell, it seems to mm-hmm. be Ruben Fine who claimed that it was women's shoes, you know, which, as I say in my book, that doesn't necessarily denote a mental yeah. illness, although it certainly is a much different, yeah. it's a much different kettle of fish than simply arranging your
yeah,
shoes.
Yeah.
But you know, in any sense, I mean, yeah, that's a harmless thing. And, you know, it's possible that someone without mental illness could do the same thing. But, you know, in his case, when you put it together with all the bizarre and, you know, very serious symptoms that he was exhibiting, yeah. it's just sort of one other manifestation of strange he was behaving at that stage of his life.
Well, it's, I mean, there's many of these stories of chess players having mental problems at a later age.
Sure.
You see Morphy as a typical example of that, or is it just someone who had an extremely brilliant mind? I mean, he also, it was said that if he went to a concert, I mean, he remembered all the music and I mean, his memory was fascinating. And then it's just a brilliant brain gone wrong. I mean, how do you say that? Is it just bad luck or?
Yeah, so it's the old question, is there a connection between brilliance and madness? Yeah. And it's hard to say, but in his case, I don't think so. I mean, his genius and his illness, his other family members, like his father was a very brilliant jurist and became Attorney General of Louisiana, and he never showed any signs of mental illness, although he did die at a relatively early age. I think it's bad luck, because the illness that he developed, it had a biological basis. Now, could there be some connection with that and his biological brilliance? Mm-hmm. Possibly, but I don't think so. I mean, a figure like Magnus Carlsen seems like a very normal human, well-adjusted human being, and he's as brilliant as any who ever lived. So I think you can pretty much put that to rest. Mm-hmm. But it's always fascinated the public, being an artist isn't always easy, and the stress of that may contribute, and that could be somewhat true for Morphy. There's the fact that he could not embrace his role, as a great chess player and as a historically important figure. A lot of the tragedy of his life is the fact that he disowned and disavowed his chess talent, and he disavowed chess as a noble occupation. And that could have in some way contributed to his illness, the fact that he became a deeply unhappy and unsatisfied person. In that sense, it's never been the easiest life choice to become a chess master, and maybe more so in America. In the United States, chess players are not as respected as they are in Europe. And in order to be a professional chess player in the United States, you pretty much have to move to Europe. It's the center of everything. So, strong American players have always faced that dilemma of, do I give up my life in the U.S. to devote myself full time to chess? Or, except for Fischer, he managed, he was so strong, he managed to do that. But, it's not an easy identity in the United States being a chess, a chess genius.
Well, I think it's also something that we have to keep in mind, that his attitude towards chess, that you have to see it from the perspective of the time. It's not like a modern day chess player who says, "Well, I don't want to continue." I mean, he had his family background where playing chess was maybe connected to gambling, and he didn't want to have any such association.
That's right. Yeah, and his family did not support his chess career. They thought of it as a nice pastime, and it was great that he was good at it, and up to a point that was okay, but they expected him to be, a famous lawyer like his father. And that's another big factor, that certainly contributed to his stress. I don't think it ultimately explains a major mental illness, but it certainly didn't help his lifetime mental health and his happiness, the fact that his family disapproved, and he embodied that disapproval and decided, that they were right. And he would, he decided that all his accomplishments were trivial, And what a tragedy that yeah. is.
Well, it must have been quite a shock yeah. to the audience when he had this speech on his return, and he said, well, chess can never be a professional. I mean, it's an interesting pastime, and it's just nothing more than that.
Right.
After he won just everything right. he could have won. Yeah.
That's right. Right.
But at the same time, well, I mean, it's such a sad story, somebody having these problems. When it was apparent that he was such a noble person, what I loved is that he didn't right. want to play for money. But then, of course, there were stakes, yeah. and then he gave the money to right. the widow
of Stanley.
Yeah, of Charles Stanley.
Right. Yeah, and then he gave money to Lowenthal yeah. to furnish his new apartment in London. Yeah, he was very magnanimous and kind and had yeah. a good heart. You know, of course, he was also privileged and he didn't need the money. So, he, you know, there was that aspect yeah. of it. He could afford to be generous. But, you know, ultimately, maybe that worked against him as a chess player. If he really needed yeah. the money, you know, maybe he would have written his, you know, a book of his games as he was trying to do after the Civil War. But, you know, yeah, he could never wrap his mind around
it. Well, it felt like he was way too lazy to do that, or...
Well, yeah, you know, that's right. You know, he when it came to writing about chess, he had a reputation of being lazy. I'm not sure if he was really lazy. I'm not sure if that's a fair critique. And I think that could be partly connected to his underlying mental illness. You know, I think it was more that he just really wasn't that interested in writing that chess. He was the first sort of truth seeker in chess. You know, he was the first player to take a very objective approach to chess yeah. mastery. And he was fascinated by that. I don't think he was as fascinated by teaching.
Yeah, and maybe this was simply too mundane for him to write down a couple of notes for an amateur, while his own thoughts were so... I mean, everything that he did, I mean, he had this incredible chess talent and this incredible mind. Yeah. I mean, he's studying law, and then immediately he knows the Code of Louisiana by heart, which is hundreds of yeah. pages. Yeah, he knows by heart. Yeah. Well, when he's played this blindfold symbol and Frederick Milne Edge, he wakes up in the morning and says, "Oh, I'll give you the moves." So maybe compared to that, just writing a couple of notes to a game is just not what you want to do.
Yeah, it wasn't. You know, it just wasn't his passion, unfortunately, to write about chess and explain it. It was his passion to understand it. And, you know, as you said, he was such a genius and his memory was so astounding that I think he got bored of chess, you know, and in that way, maybe he is similar to Fischer, that once he conquered the world, what was there left for him to do or to prove in chess? And especially since he didn't have a passion for writing or teaching, where could he go from there, you know? He demolished Anderson. You know, what was the point of continuing to play? You know, in a way, maybe even Magnus dealt with some of that in modern times. He was so good and, you know, and so dominant. What was there left to prove? So there came a point where he took a break, you know, and that was certainly true of Fischer. You know, he had this passion to beat the Russians, you know, the same way that Morphy wanted to beat Staunton and to sort of expose Staunton's legacy as not the highest form of chess thinking. You know, once they reached their goals, they lost their ambition to work at chess, because, you know, chess at the highest levels is very, very hard work.
This podcast is brought to you by DGT, the Chess Innovators,
Discover your perfect chess friend. The DGT Centaur is a chess computer that automatically adapts itself to your playing strength. It gives you a fair chance to win, to learn, and most importantly, to have fun. To find your nearest DGT dealer, please visit our website at dgt.nl.
Well, your book, the Real Paul Morphy, is also, well, it's a clear attempt to keep Morphy's legacy alive. And you feel that this is something that he deserves, and the beauty of his games, the amazing story of his life, although it ended sadly. Was that something you had in mind when you wanted to, I mean, you also call it the Real Paul Morphy. Which were the things that you wanted to highlight that you think had been slightly ignored so far?
So there were several things. One of them was that, you know, the one great biography by Lawson. So you have a great biography, and then you have several Morphy game collections, many of which were written a long time ago. But you never had a book that sewed together everything, you know, that combined an in-depth biography with his games, and, you know, put his games in the context of his life events. And I just thought that was a real void. You know, it would be like reading a book about Picasso without seeing any of his paintings. You know, here's this great artist, and you know his story to a chess player is kind of empty without the context of the games he played. You know, it just needed to be put together and synthesized to get the full effect of his story. So, you know, that's one thing I wanted to focus on. As I got into studying Morphy, I found some openings for, making new connections about it, his ancestry, and diving deeper into that. And I found that very interesting, as an amateur biographer and historian. There's a lot still, there's so much information out there about Morphy that hasn't been synthesized. So I tried to do that, you know, as best I could, in a new way, and, you know, in a more in-depth way. I also wanted to go much deeper than previous authors had into setting the scene for Morphy, you know, painting a picture of what the chess world was like when Morphy entered, so that you could get a better understanding of the impact he had, and of how far ahead of his time he was. So I devoted, you know, a very long chapter to really, you know, exploring in depth the games of Staunton and Anderson, and also the evolution of chess history and chess theory up to that point, so you can get a better sense of Morphy's.
Yeah, you wade into this discussion about the romantics. I mean, how romantic were they? How not romantic were they? And it's great that, let's say, after all these years, we have this very lively discussion about that. And of course, Willy Hendricks, he plays a very important role in this. And partly you agree, partly you disagree. And it sounds like a discussion that is far from over. What do you think?
I think it's very far from over. I think that Hendricks is one of the greatest chess writers of our time. His prose flows like honey, and it looks very easy to do that. It's actually very hard. So I think he's a wonderful writer, but I disagree with him, you know, very much in regards to, in his book On the Origin of Good Moves, he very much puts Morphy in the background and puts Anderson front and center, in the in the evolution of chess ideas. And I think he very much underestimates Morphy's influence and Staunton's influence for that matter. You know, he tries to paint the idea that Andersen was not such a romantic. He was just a great player. And, you know, during my research for this book, I have gone back and studied every game in the databases from, you know, the beginning of time up to Morphy. I've looked at every game, and I've, you know, the more I study Andersen, I do believe that he was the pinnacle of romantic chess. I believe that he was a great player, but that I'll lay it out this way. Staunton was the first champion with a positional style, and he was also the first pragmatist. He elevated winning, you know, above beauty. Now, the romantics put beauty on an equal par, at least, with winning. And Andersen, in that sense, he was someone who always strove for beauty and for combinations. So there are many instances in his games where a simple move would have been decisive. And instead, he chose a much more complicated move, which often was not decisive, often was unsound, but his opponents were not strong enough, you know, to expose that. And he was so strong tactically. You know, he was, they call him the world's first super GM. You know, he was head and shoulders above his opponents tactically. So, but he loved the beauty of combinations, you know, as a problemist and as a player. And he would take risks, even in games of tremendous importance, just for the sheer joy of, you know, seeing what happens. You know, he was just fascinated with variations and combinations. And then along comes Morphy, and Morphy's a different animal from Staunton or Andersen. He grew up as a romantic, so he had a love of combinations and open games. But as he matures as a chess player, what he realizes is he's looking for the objective best move in any situation, and he's the first player who is a dominant, transcendent player in every phase of the game. So he's just trying to study objectively, you know, what are the best moves in the opening, how to be most accurate in the ending. He's just striving for truth and more accuracy. And he's the first player ever to take that approach. And I think that Kasparov called him the prototype of the modern grandmaster that way. I agree with that. And I think he had a tremendous influence on people like Steinitz, because Steinitz comes along and says, you know, chess is a more scientific game, and the romantics were unsound, you know, their combinations were unsound. And so Staunton promotes a scientific school. Well, I think the first scientific player was Paul Morphy. And Staunton can't admit that, because he was always laboring in Morphy's shadow. Because, you know, Morphy was an absolute legend for, you know, over 100 years. It's hard for us to realize today, because we're so far apart in time. But he cast an enormous shadow over the whole chess world for, you know, I mean, even in the time of Capablanca, you know, Capablanca was calling Morphy the greatest player who ever lived. So, to say that Andersen had a greater impact on the development of chess theory than Andersen, I think that's a big mistake. And I also think you have to give Staunton a lot of credit, you know, for the development of positional ideas, because that's the one area where Morphy fell a little bit short, was that he didn't realize fully the validity of positional chess and of Staunton's approach. He was a positional master, Morphy, but he was an attacking positional player, and he disliked a more slow stodgy positional approach.
Yeah.
He had an aversion to that.
Yeah. Well, as you say, I mean, this discussion is far from over, and of course, it's not for nothing that Bobby Fischer, that he included Staunton in his 10 greatest player of all time, and that there was a time that he was totally addicted to Anderson's games. I mean, there were reasons for that.
Well,
at the start, you said that you first were planning a book on 5 great American players. So you've done one now. Is Harry Pillsbury next in line? What's the plan?
The problem with Harry Pillsbury is I think there is very scant biographical information available. And he was an incredible player and incredibly strong and incredibly interesting. No, I don't think I am going to go in that direction. I think I'm more now drawn to go further back because I got so fascinated in, doing a deep dive into chess evolution that I would like to go back before Morphy and, do a deeper dive into romantic chess and, sort of the development of chess ideas before Morphy, because it's very interesting. Romanticism is not a dirty word. And the interesting thing is that I think we could have more respect for romanticism in a sense with the onset of modern computer analysis, because, for instance, openings like the Evans Gambit and the Bishop's Gambit, variation of the King's Gambit, those are good openings. The machines like them pretty well. And these guys, there was a lot of theory being written in these openings. There were many, many areas of chess knowledge that were, basically non-existent by modern standards, but there were some areas in the romantic vein where they actually dove pretty deeply and, in some ways probably understood these positions better than modern masters would. So I find all that all that very interesting.
So enough work waiting for you.
Yeah.
But for the moment, let me thank you for this beautiful book, Charles. I mean, it's I'm a Morphy fan, and it's a delight to have the story and the games in chronological order and the new findings that you have. I mean, I'm not the right person to recommend this, but I would definitely do so. It's a wonderful book, and I thank you for that.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the New in Chess podcast. The New in Chess podcast is published every Friday and can be listened to on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and the New in Chess website. To leave a comment, go to our socials or email us directly at podcast@newinchess.com. If you're interested in Charles Hurton's The Real Paul Morphy, 385 pages about one of the greatest chess geniuses in history, please go to the webshop on our website, newinchess.com. There you will find all the details how you can easily order the book. We thank our sponsors at DGT for their support and hope to have you back next week for a new episode of the New in Chess podcast.